The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, when I was at high school, I hated school photo day. I'm not in that photo. I hated school photo day. It wasn't that I hated being in front of a camera. There's plenty of embarrassing photos of me as a teenager that prove I was not camera shy. But I hated school photo day because every year when they took their year group photo, it was just an objective reminder that I was one of the shortest guys in the year. I was at the back of the line, and on that measure, I felt less significant compared to my peers. I hated school photo day. And I'm sure we've all, at different situations, felt unimportant, where we felt insignificant. Maybe despite your best efforts on a project, you've been overlooked. Maybe it's been realising that in your workplace you're a smaller cog than you had thought. Maybe as your children have grown up and become less dependent on you, it's raised questions of, well, what role do I have? Sooner or later, we all face the question, am I significant? Do I matter? And before we start considering how to respond to that question, I think we actually need to acknowledge that at a certain scale, human beings are insignificantly small. The universe is a huge place, and you and I are insignificantly small. If we were meeting out in the country, away from all the light pollution and at night, I might say, let's just go out and look at the night sky for a moment, but we're not. We're in the city in the middle of the day with lots of light pollution. So instead, have a look at this photo of an ultra-deep field photo taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's beautiful, but take just a moment now to consider the scale of what you're looking at. Now, to the naked eye, the patch of sky that this photo was taken from actually appears empty. Yet the image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope reveals that in this apparently empty piece of sky, there are around 10,000 galaxies, up to 10 billion light years away, and each of these galaxies contains billions upon billions of stars. And this is just a small portion of the night sky. It's a small portion of our universe. Now, I don't know about you, but initially, I'm kind of impressed. I think, wow, the universe is big, unbelievably big, like the sort of numbers that I can't even really comprehend big. But then comes the realization that comparatively, I'm actually pretty small. And small in a way that actually has far more weight than just realizing I'm small on school photo day. In the grand scheme of the universe, I'm insignificantly small. How do you respond to that reality? It's a question in the middle of the psalm that we're looking at today. Have a look at verse 3 and 4 that Nat read out earlier. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you set in place, what is mankind that you're mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them? How do you respond to the reality that, well, we're actually pretty small and insignificant creatures? In case you missed Craig's welcome before, let me just add my welcome and say it's great to have you joining us at Bible Shots this week, where we set some time aside in our day to consider what part of the Bible, what it has to say to us. Not everyone who comes to Bible Shots would say they were a follower of Jesus, but many of us are. But as long as you're happy to consider what the Bible says, we're glad to have you along as we grapple with some of these questions. And thanks as well for joining us in the side chapel today. Normally we're meeting in the main hall, but they're starting to do some construction work in there. And I'm told that the construction is expected to be finished by the end of the year, so next year we'll be fine, we'll be straight back in there, and I can't imagine there'll be any problems with that. But at least here, even though it's a little bit cozier, there is some air conditioning. If you're OCD like me, the screen being a little bit tilted might annoy you, but we can work through that. And you do get a little bit used to the smell after a few minutes. So they're all problems we can overcome, and we still have a space that we can meet. But you've also joined us for the first talk in our series, Words of the Warrior Poet, where we're looking at some of the Psalms of David. In case you're not familiar with those terms, Psalms are basically poems in the Bible, and David, who wrote many of the Psalms, was also a warrior, and he became the king of ancient Israel. Hence, the words of the warrior poet. That's what we're looking at today. David also struggled with a lot of the big problems that we all face. And many of the Psalms touch on these issues, and today we're considering Psalm 8 and the question that it raises about significance, our place in the universe. And so there's three main parts to today's talk. First, we're going to think about the impact of perspective. Then we're going to do most of our work in the second section, unpacking Psalm 8. And we'll finish just quickly thinking through a couple of the alternatives as we consider, where do I look for meaning and significance? So first, the impact of perspective, because there are actually different ways you can answer this question of significance. The way that you understand reality shapes how you interpret the experience of feeling insignificant. In Psalm 8, we see that significance is given to God by his people, but that's not the only option out there that people have put forward to answer that question of significance. In fact, David's not the only one who's considered the heavens, felt insignificant, and sung a song about it. At the end of Monty Python's Meaning of Life, Eric Idle sang, "Now the sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day in the outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of a galaxy we call the Milky Way." And as he reflected on this and what it means for meaning, he said, "So remember, when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth." Eric Idle considers the size of the universe and his place within it interpreted through his understanding of how the world works. The size and scale of the universe just reinforce the fact that everything, including your existence, is chance. It's random. In another song that he sang at the end of The Life of Brian, he expands on this line of thinking. He says, "While life's quite absurd and death's the final word, life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You come from nothing, you go back to nothing. What have you lost? Nothing. So, always look on the bright side of life." So you can see how his worldview actually shapes how he responds to this feeling of insignificance. Idle says, you know, if you're feeling insecure and small, well, yeah, that's true. Ultimately, life is meaningless. So, you just make the best of whatever situation you're in. That's the way forward. It's an answer to the question of significance, although it's a very different answer to David's answer in Psalm 8. Your worldview shapes how you understand this question and how you answer it. And so we're actually going to be spending most of today unpacking Psalm 8. And we've got three subpoints here. God's plan commencing, God's plan continuing, and God's plan completed. Now, just to set some expectations, we are going to be doing some heavy thinking in the next section, and we'll be moving through fairly quickly. So if I move past a point too quickly, please do ask in question time. Make a note and ask us in question time. But by the end, I think we will see how God's plans for humanity actually give a really solid basis for the problem of significance, despite how small we actually are in a big, big universe. So first, God's plan commencing. The language that David uses in the psalm, he actually draws on some of the opening words of the Bible and God's plans for creation and humanity. At the start of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, it reads, "And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night. And it was so. God made two lights, the greater to govern the day, the lesser the light to govern the night. He also made the stars." And David reflects on this in the psalm. Verse 1, "You set your glory above the heavens." He starts focusing on the heavens. Verse 3, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have made." David's thinking about God's work in creation. Also in Genesis 1, 26, back to Genesis, David says, we read, "Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea, and the birds of the sky, the livestock, and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." And in Psalm 8, you can see there in verses 6 and 8 in your handout, David says, "You made humanity rulers over the world, over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds, and the animals of the wild, the birds of the sky, the fish of the sea, all that swim in the paths of the sea. David considers the role that God gave humanity in creation as he's grappling with these questions. And David, as he's confronted with creation and humanity's smallness and apparently insignificance, interprets the experience with this lens of Scripture, the lens of the Bible. David says, wow, you know, you included humans in your plans for creation. The God of the universe who created all this, actually, he gave humans a position of ruling creation. Even when I feel small and insecure and insignificant, God, who made this, he has given meaning and significance. He has included humans in his plan. Wow. But you know, as nice as this idea sounds, it doesn't take me long to think, hang on. There's things that seem out of tune with reality. There's some things there that just don't seem to add up. I mean, the idea of ruling over creation sounds nice, but it's not my experience, and plenty of people are terrible at it. Surely it's not one of God's great ideas. First, it's not my experience of reality. You know, I do have a fish, Bruce. He looks a lot like this. And I guess in some sense I exercise authority over him. I exercise rule over him. I feed him. I keep his bowl clean-ish. But if that's what the psalm's talking about, you know, it's a bit of a letdown. But second, and more seriously, you know, when I think about people who are really in positions to exercise rule and authority, I've got to ask, is it really one of God's best ideas? You know, when you think of some of the despots and tyrants who rule countries, or on a smaller scale rule offices, or a smaller scale again rule their homes in a way that exploits and crushes the people that they should be caring for, well, not to mention the exploitation of the world and its resources for selfish ends, I've got to wonder, is that really one of God's good ideas? I mean, there's far too many cases of people abusing power that we have to think this really actually works, that this is a good thing. There's two problems there. I don't experience God's rule over creation, and people with power abuse it and fail. So it might seem like David's perspective here in the psalm out of tune with reality, but I think he's aware of the problem. We saw that David is drawing on the language of Genesis to remind us of the place that humanity has in God's plans for creation. But that's not all. Have a look in verse 2 there. We see that God has enemies. Now, just as a bit of background, in the Bible, sin is a rejection of God as the ruler of the world, a rebellion against his ways, a setting ourselves up as an alternative government, as enemies to God's rule. See, what was true of humanity, that we were made in the image of God to govern his creation in a way that reflects his goodness, has actually been shattered by sin. Humans are still made in the image of God, but our sin, which can be seen in many ways, including the exploitation of those who should be being cared for, our sin has actually fractured that image of God. We can't fulfill the plan that God had for us. Well, we've seen in Psalm 8, there's grounds for our significance in God's plans for humanity, but that there's also this problem of sin. But it also points to a way forward. We see here God's plans for humanity continuing. When we read the Bible, and particularly when we read the Psalms, we need to pay careful attention to the language that's used. Now, in your handout, you might not have noticed as we were reading through, but there's actually a language issue to be aware of. The NIV version printed in your handout, it actually has footnotes at the bottom, and you'll notice they provide an alternative way to read verses 4, 5, and 6. It suggests a singular instead of a plural in verses 4, 5, and 6. I've put it on the screen just to make it a little bit easier to follow. It says, well, what is a human being that you are mindful of him? A son of man that you care for him? You've made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honour. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet. See, while you can understand the language in humanity in general sense, you can also understand it as a singular person. What was true of humanity might now actually have shifted to an individual. Also, the title, A Psalm of David, which is a part of the psalm, actually suggests we should have David in mind as we consider the message of the psalm and what it means and how it all ties together. If you're not familiar with David, that's okay. We'll be learning a little bit more about him over the next couple of weeks. But David came from humble beginnings as a shepherd boy to become the king of ancient Israel. David, like humanity in general, was small and weak, yet God used him to achieve great things. But also, David, like humanity in general, has the same problem we do. He didn't represent God perfectly. He did exploit and crush people he was responsible for, adultery and murder being two of the most memorable. The problem that's present in humanity in general is also present in David specifically. But there is a part of David's life that I think actually helps us understand the hope that's held out for all of us in the worldview of the psalm. There's one story about David worth remembering, which I think helps us understand the psalm and points to a way forward. See, God promised David a child who would represent God in the way that David and we failed to do. We see this starting here at 2 Samuel chapter 7. God speaking to David, "The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. Your house and your kingdom shall endure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." God promised David a child who would be a king and ultimately would fulfill God's plans for humanity. And it does kind of fit with the psalm text that we're looking at. There's that question about a child in verse 2. You know, how does, through the praise of infants and children, you have established a stronghold against your enemies? Well, actually, God promised David this child that would establish a kingdom. It also fits into the wider story of the Bible. Ever since Genesis and humanity's rebellion against God, God's people were looking for someone to fix this problem of sin, this problem that actually really ruptured the source of meaning and significance that we had that comes from God. The story focused on this search, and it focused down onto this promise to King David and his offspring. And this is where there's real hope, meaning, and significance for us in God's promise here. When we read the psalm carefully, it actually suggests we're not focused on humanity in general, but on a specific person. David's child, who would fulfill God's plans for the world. And as the Old Testament continues, it keeps looking forward to this one who would fulfill God's promise. And it's not until we get to the New Testament that we see God's plan completed, around 1,000 years after David wrote this psalm. In the New Testament, they actually see Jesus as the ultimate fulfillment of this psalm, the one who it ultimately points to. One of the New Testament writers, in Hebrews chapter 2, he quotes the psalm. He says, you know, there's a place where someone has testified, "Mankind, that you are mindful of them, a son of man, that you care for him. You made them a little lower than the angels. You crowned them with glory and honour. You put everything under their feet." And he teases out. He says, you know, in putting everything under them, God left nothing that is not subject to them, talking about people. "But at present, we do not yet see everything subject to them," which we saw is our experience. We don't really see rule beyond, you know, maybe taking care of a fish. We see that experience. But, he says, we do see Jesus, who was made lower than the angels for a little while, now crowned with glory and honour, because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. Now, there's more to unpack in there than we've got time to do, but notice that it is Jesus who, though appearing insignificant, weak and helpless, when he died on the cross, he tasted death so that we didn't need to. Jesus established a stronghold against death, one of the great enemies that we face. And that's not for good people. No, it's for those of us who were God's enemies, those of us who have walked away from God and spat on his ways. God made Jesus the perfect king who exercises his good rule and dominion, who rules for the good of his people, such that if we trust him, we actually don't need to fear death. And in fact, the New Testament goes on to say, if we trust Jesus, we're also welcomed into God's family, and we're granted a share of Jesus' rule. We are restored to that plan for humanity that God had in the beginning. See, the idea that God includes humans in his plan for creation, it might seem like a denial of reality, but in light of who Jesus is and what God has promised to people who follow him, actually, I think there's no greater foundation for human significance. No wonder David starts and ends the psalm praising God's majestic name. God, the creator and saviour of the world, gives us meaning and significance. Well, we're getting close to finished. I did say at the start we were going to do some heavy lifting, thinking and move quickly, but we've seen that Psalm 8 interprets that experience of insignificance and smallness through the lens of Scripture, through what God has revealed about himself. And so I hope you can see that actually, if you are feeling small and insecure, it says, well, remember what God has revealed in his plans and does for us in his King Jesus. When you feel small and insecure, actually, if you trust Jesus, you can marvel that God has included us in his plans, despite the fact that we are small and insignificant. That if you trust Jesus, you are significant and are included in God's future plans for his creation. That is something to marvel at and to thank God for. And I think it's a much more solid basis for significance than any of the alternatives that are often offered when we feel small and insecure. So to finish, just two common alternatives to sources of significance that are held out for us. The first is, my significance comes from what I do. It's from what I've achieved. Now, if we're thinking psalms and poems and songs, I think it's exemplified by Queen's We Are the Champions. I love the song, but I think it exemplifies that kind of an alternative way of thinking, because it's all about what I have done and what I have achieved. But when you think about it, whether it's sporting, academic, commercial success, if it's achievements that prove I'm worthwhile, that I'm significant, those achievements can be good things, but they're actually a terrible basis for significance. I mean, there's the problem that can go along with pride. Beyond that, there's always the threat of being eclipsed by someone who has achieved more than me. There's the need to keep achieving. And what's more, whatever my achievements in this life, there's always going to be an insignificance to them at a big enough scale. Consider Alexander the Great's achievements in the size and scope of the universe. Well, and they're still pretty insignificant in the grand scheme of things. Seeking significance in achievement is a fool's errand. It can't last. The second alternative starts with the assumption, I am inherently significant, and continues, therefore, everything about me is worth celebrating. And I think if we're thinking songs and poems that kind of exemplify this, This Is Me by Keila Settle from the Greatest Showman album is a great example. Another great song that's fun to sing, but kind of captures this alternative that I think is ultimately hollow. Because it only works as long as you can keep believing, that you can keep convincing yourself that, yeah, I'm inherently significant. But as Eric Idle pointed out, you know, if everything is that big around us, and if everything is random, then you aren't significant. To claim you are is really just a denial of the fact. You aren't inherently significant. You can only keep claiming I am significant as long as you can fool yourself into believing that that's true. There are lots of alternatives out there to the question of significance, but today we've actually seen in detail, well, what's one way that the Bible answers that question of, am I significant? Because if David's right in Psalm 8, there is actually a solid answer that makes sense of the question and the world that we live in. We're creatures who were created for great things, but rebel against our Creator. But if we follow Jesus, when we feel small and insecure, actually we don't need to despair. We can know, actually, even though that's true, God has still included us in his plans for creation through his Son. And that is a solid foundation for grappling with this question. Yeah, so I'll just get my Bible. So in Psalm, where are we going, Craig? We're still in advance. So in Psalm 8, it does talk about a son of man. Was that the question that you were talking about? In verse, where are we? Or was that the alternative one idea? Yeah. So it does say a son of man, and Jesus actually uses that as one of his titles. When Jesus used the title son of man, to cut a long story short because we're out of time, it was a title that was, I guess, not a loaded term, but was still one from the Old Testament. So he used that as a way of describing and referring to himself. It can also be used in the sense of more a person generally. So it could just mean a human being. I suspect in Psalm 8, it's more got that flavour of a person generally, rather than that being a specific, messianic, Jesus-type title use. But there are parts of the psalm that do point to that. So the child, I think, particularly is that promise being looked forward to there. But is a good question. So if that is another possible link to Jesus, I'm just not convinced there's a strong argument for it going through the text.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.